And welcome back to the second half of Earth First Radio. I'm Uncle Dennis, and there's more important information coming up, so please keep that pencil and recycled paper handy, and we'll get right on into our commentary for this week, like we do at the start of the second half of every show. And today's commentary is the Agent Green Report. This is the UN Biodiversity Convention to Stop Dangerous U.S. Fungus Experiments. This one really gave me the creeps, folks. In a detailed report released recently, the Sunshine Project, a new international nonprofit dedicated to exposing abuses of biotechnology, calls on the upcoming Nairobi meeting of the UN Biodiversity Convention to halt the United States' dangerous experiments with fungi designed to kill narcotic crops. Intended to kill opium poppies, coca, and cannabis plants, the microbes present risks to human health and biodiversity. There is imminent danger that a highly infectious fungus will be deliberately released in Andean and Amazonian centers of diversity. The U.S.-backed fungi have already been used experimentally on opium poppy and cannabis fields in the United States and in Central Asia. Fungus targets include hundreds of thousands of cultivated hectares of narcotic crop-producing countries in the South, Southeast, and Central Asia, along with Mexico, Central, and South America. American countries, 30 years after the heavy use of toxic herbicides such as Agent Orange in the Vietnam War, the United States is planning the use of a biological agent called Agent Green in the drug war. The strains of the fungi Fusarium oxysporum and Pleospora pauversae might infect and kill plants other than coca, poppy, and cannabis in ecologically sensitive areas of Asia and the Americas. U.S. Department of Agriculture researchers have never tested the host range of Agent Green on plant species native to target countries, including Colombia, which is currently the number one on the U.S. list of places to use the fungi. Only a limited number of commercial crops were tested, which is little indication of how the fungi will behave in the varied and poorly understood real-world ecologies where they might be used. The USA is playing roulette with irreplaceable biological diversity, says Susana Pimimento Chamorro, a Colombian lawyer with the Sunshine Project. In Colombia, four close relatives of coca are already listed as endangered. Agent Green might be the last step to their extinction. It is well known that some strains of Fusarium oxysporum can infect many different plants, even distantly related species. To avoid disturbing delicate ecosystems in the Amazon, rural Southeast Asia, and the Andes, the fungi must not be released. One of the most highly prized butterflies in the world, the Agrius, depends on coca's wild relatives in the Amazonian rainforest. Plants in the coca genus are the butterfly's host plant, the only place where the young larvae can feed and mature. A beautiful fast flyer listed as endangered in Brazil, one of Agrius's centers of speciation is the upper Putumayo region, river region, precisely where the United States intends to apply the heaviest doses of the coca-killing fungus. If the fungus attacks wild coca relatives, it will ultimately hurt the Agrius butterfly. Even more disturbing is the fact that strains of Fusarium oxysporum are highly toxic to animals and humans. Birds feeding on plant seeds are endangered, and consumption of the coca leaves, which is legal in Peru and Bolivia, might pose a health threat. Fusaria can produce mycotoxins that are deadly enough to be considered weapons of war and are listed as biological agents in the draft protocol to the Biological and Toxic Weapons Convention, said Sunshine Project biologist Dr. Jan van Aken. U.S. researchers have not tested Agent Green's production of these deadly mycotoxins. Once released into the environment, the deadly fungus cannot be recalled. Indeed, the coca fungus appears to have escaped scientists' grasp when it jumped into control plots during field tests in Hawaii. The fungus has clearly been rejected in the U.S., the world's number one producer of illicit cannabis. Last year, the Florida Environmental Protection Agency emphatically opposed and halted a proposed use of Fusaria. According to the agency's director, it is difficult, if not impossible, to control the spread of Fusarium species. The mutated fungi can cause disease in a large number of crops. Fusarium species are more active in warm soils and can stay resident in the soils for years. U.S. officials have failed to obtain the financial backing of other governments for the plan, except for modest support from the United Kingdom for the poppy killer. No other donor country has financially backed the idea, but this has not stopped the United States drug warriors from pressuring Asian and South American countries. Through the offices of the UN Drug Control Program, pressure is being put on Colombia especially, which is being asked to sign a field testing contract. Ironically, it was under Colombian leadership that the recent biosafety protocol negotiations were successfully concluded, and Colombia's environment minister is now president of the high-level UN Commission on Sustainable Development. According to the Sunshine Project's Edward Hammond, An obvious and flagrant flaw in the fungal eradication plan is that microbes pay no attention to passport and visa requirements. The fungus can spread without regard to political borders, potentially attacking legal crops in countries that do not agree to its use, and there are many potential victims. Canadian industrial hemp growers have expressed concern about U.S. plans. Fungus applications in coca-growing areas in southern Colombia, for example, might lead to U.S. infections in Ecuador, Brazil, and Peru, a legal coca producer. Use in Central and South Asia, for example, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Turkmenistan, could lead to losses in bordering India, which under a strict licensing system produces about half of the world's pharmaceutical opiates. In Southeast Asia, a variety of disastrous scenarios can be envisioned where opium poppy areas, for example, in Burma, border on Laos, Thailand, and China, which produces opiates for domestic pharmaceutical use. If developing country production of legal pharmaceutical opiates is damaged by fungus spread, industrialized producers like Australia, which has already planted extra potent genetically engineered opium poppies, could increase their market share. I wonder what's really going on here. Back to the editorial. The rights of indigenous people who cultivate the target crops for traditional non-drug uses are also endangered. In South Asia, poppies are used in traditional medicine and plant material used as fodder. Coca has been used for over a millennium as traditional medicine in Colombia and Argentina. Under the Biodiversity Convention, indigenous peoples are afforded rights to their biodiversity, including medicinal plants. Indigenous people live close to where fungus is applied, may become innocent drug war victims. The United States says that fungus varieties it wants to use in developing countries are not genetically engineered, but it has created genetically modified strains in the laboratory. U.S. scientists have also cloned virulent genes from related fungi, Fusarium strains that attack potatoes, with the possible intent of increasing the kill rate of anti-drug fungi through biotechnology. A consequence of permitting testing and use of current fungi will be future pressure for countries to allow enhanced living modified organism fungi to be used. Governments have a legitimate need to control narcotic crops, but doing so through the use of an Agent Green microbe is profoundly misguided and sets an alarming precedent. If governments are idle while microbial agents are developed to attack narcotic crops, how will they protect biodiversity if microbes are developed to kill other unpopular and regulated crops like tobacco, kava, betel nut, palm, peyote, ayahuasca, or hops? The Sunshine Project, which sent its report to 500 government delegates from 100 countries, is suggesting several options for government action during the conference that took place May 15th through the 26th. Delegates should adopt a resolution calling for a halt to the U.S. program and condemning the use of any microbe for the purpose of eradicating cultivated crops. Such a resolution is not a statement on drug policy, but instead a reiteration of fundamental objectives of the convention. The Convention on Biological Diversity cannot remain quiet while agents are developed by a non-party to deliberately obliterate biodiversity, especially plants with the legitimate medicinal and traditional uses. And the CBD may also consider studying the fungus under its agriculture program because of the fungus's impacts on pollinators and soil diversity, both specific responsibilities of the convention. Governments may also request the CBD executive secretary to urgently convey the CBD's views to the United National Drug Control Program, which has been, sometimes reluctantly, helping implementation of the U.S. program. And the Sunshine Project is an international nonprofit organization dedicated to bringing information to light on harmful abuses of biotechnology. The project has expert staff with training in law, policy, and biology, and with lengthy experience on policy issues. The project has offices in Hamburg, Germany, and Seattle in the United States. If you'd like more information, visit their website, www.sunshine-project.org. That's sunshine-project.org. And we want to thank the Sunshine Project for tonight's commentary. Back to activist news. In Portland, 100 people gathered in front of the U.S. federal courthouse a few days ago to protest the harassment of activists by the unjust grand jury system. Both Craig Rosebrough of Portland and Josh Harper of Seattle were commanded to testify regarding several actions of economic sabotage claimed by either the Earth Liberation Front or the Animal Liberation Front. Rosebrough's subpoena was cut off with a statement that the grand jury didn't have the time to deal with both him and Harper. For Rosebrough, who receives anonymous communiques from the Underground Earth Liberation Front and passes them on to the media and the public nationwide, this is his seventh subpoena since 1997. Josh Harper, who recently received his first subpoena while fighting whaling off the Olympic Peninsula, has decided to defy the grand jury subpoena completely by not only not verbally cooperating, but also not showing up at all. In his statement, he said, first and foremost, and this is part of his statement. First and foremost, this world is dying. All that is beautiful about the world is being destroyed and paved over. The animals are being either killed or turned into machines for human consumption. Our society, which has for thousands of years mostly been peaceful and egalitarian, is now filled with neurosis, discontent, and alienation. But there is more out there. All of our rage, all of our anger at this system can be focused into positive action. This grand jury wants to stop that positive action. Although the ALF and ELF are only small parts of a bigger effort for autonomy, freedom, and a progression to an intact Earth, they are important because they show us that we can fight back and we can win. I will not betray them by speaking with their enemies. And secondly, as an anarchist, I would never willingly cooperate with the grand jury system. The very idea that this government presumes they can command me to do anything shows how very little they know me. My life is my own, my thoughts are my own, and what I decide to do will not be dictated to me by judges, attorneys, and their lackeys with guns. If they want me, let them come and get me. They can drag me into the grand jury room, but they can never make me speak. A statement by Josh Harper. And a militant group based in the United States is preparing to violently disrupt the next meeting of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank at the Czech capital Prague. This according to James Wolfenson, president of the World Bank. I'm very much afraid for Prague, Wolfenson said. The president of the World Bank is in The Hague for a meeting with 60 members of the parliament from several European and African countries regarding development aid. A previous meeting of the IMF and World Bank in Washington, D.C. last April was disrupted by protesters. The international protest action started this last December in Seattle during the meeting of the World Trade Organization. Until now, protests were relatively nonviolent, but Wolfenson fears the worst for the upcoming meeting in Prague. Quote, in the U.S., a militant group resides called Ruckus. Already now, this group is training for Prague. They teach how to make Molotov cocktails and how to protest in other violent ways. A female U.S. billionaire is backing this organization in defense of the Ruckus Society. They don't teach you how to make Molotov cocktails, and they do teach nonviolent protests. You've got it wrong. And they will be in Prague. In other activist news, first worldwide biotech exhibition has been shut down in Italy. The first worldwide biotech exhibition in Genoa, Italy, was shut down by a determined battling demonstration for a few hours last week. In the demonstration, several were injured and two arrested. 10,000 demonstrators gathered at 9 a.m. in front of the Genoa Brunel station, I believe that's a train station, for what is now being called by the media the Italian Seattle. There were people from all over Italy, Switzerland, France, and Germany. More than 400 grassroots groups endorsed this demonstration. There were anarchists from Milan, Genoa, and Rome, and social centers from all over Italy, and lots of groups from the Green Galaxy, including Greenpeace, the World Wildlife Fund, and others. Demo started at 10:30. In front of the demo were the mobile Tebbio, the coordinators of the event, followed by at least 1,000 white coveralls ready for civil disobedience with gas mask shields and padding all over the body. But they carried no arms, no sticks, no stones, or no bottles. Sounds like an interesting concept that people might want to think about. Get suited up for that demonstration, just all what you need to face peacefully a police attack. Behind there were the anarchists and all the rest of the people. Greens and reformed communists were in the back. They marched directly from the station to the exhibition, guarded by 3,000 anti-riot policemen. Once they arrived, the confrontation was almost immediate. We wanted to enter, they wanted to keep us out and away, while some dozen CEOs and scientists were inside deciding our future. The first police attack started when the white coveralls advanced toward the entrance gates. It was wild, and the confrontation was made extremely difficult by a helicopter flying over all the time, some 10 meters above our heads. That's about 30 feet. While the white coveralls' protections were good enough to resist the attack and push back the cops against the gate. There followed a half an hour of full of tension. Then came the second police attack. This was extremely difficult to contain because they attacked on two sides, the front and the right side was not protected by the padded white coveralls, so people had to resist with bare hands. And there we had their wounded comrades, at least four. One demonstrator hurt in the leg by something unknown, maybe a rubber bullet, was taken to the hospital. However, the second attack was pushed back and the exhibition was besieged. Under a very hot sun, more than 5,000 people kept on yelling slogans and blocking the entrance gate. Nobody can enter or exit anymore, not even the cops, which retreated behind the closed gates. The large square in front of the exhibition was now completely controlled by demonstrators. Finally, the police gave up and the exhibition was suspended for the whole afternoon. This announcement raised a lot of enthusiasm among the demonstrators, which slowly started to move toward the mobile Tebio village where a camping was set up a week ago and large tents hosted the coordination point, an exhibition of biological projects and people arriving in Genoa without tents. The Italian government withdrew its endorsement of the exhibition. Half of the biotech companies invited did not show up, fearing protests. Exhibitors of other industrial products denounced the sudden drop in visitors, asking the biotech organizers to pay damages, and many Italian cities have declared themselves biotech-free territory. In short, it was a good, swift kick in their fat asses. You want more information? Contact Giuliano. His email address, acunzoli at tin.it. And Canadian logging protesters jailed as judge sets new benchmark. Four people who broke a court order in protesting logging in the Alajo Valley north of Vancouver will do jail time. The British Columbia Supreme Court justice imposed terms of 14 to 56 days on three Canadians and an American who pleaded guilty to civil contempt in court. In separate incidents of road blockading, the four who did not know one another violated an injunction against interfering with work by International Forest Project products in an area noted for its thousand-year-old Douglas fir trees. Unfortunately, there are nine other people who will be tried for criminal contempt. A former Hamline University Law School Dean Stephen Young, who argued that two environmental groups should be prohibited from trying to reduce logging on federal forests, was fined $5,000 by a federal judge for pursuing a baseless lawsuit. In the suit, loggers argued the activists were influenced by the religion of deep ecology, an earth-centered religious belief system similar to American Indian spirituality, and shouldn't be allowed to impose their beliefs on the U.S. Forest Service. U.S. District Judge James Rosenbaum said the lawsuit by Associated Contract Loggers and Olson Logging of Orr, Minnesota was, quote, inherently offensive to the orderly processes of law and of this court. Rosenbaum dismissed it in February, saying there was no justification for it, and ordered the attorney Young to show cause why he shouldn't be sanctioned for pursuing it. In last Friday's order, Rosenbaum said Young, quote, obdurably refused to seriously discuss or provide a legally cognizable basis for his actions. As a result, he ordered Young to pay $2,500 each to two nonprofit groups, St. Paul-based Superior Wilderness Action Network and the New Mexico-based Forest Guardians, sued by the loggers. Swan and others have tried many times in recent years to stop or delay logging in the Superior National Forest in northeastern Minnesota. Moving on to other news, public health advocates are demanding that the Food and Drug Administration close loopholes in animal feed regulations to prevent the spread in the U.S. of mad cow-type diseases, which are now at epidemic levels in western deer and elk, that might infect people who eat the meat. In a letter sent to the Food and Drug Administration, the Center for Food Safety and the Humane Farming Association and families of U.S. victims of the human version of mad cow disease, also known as Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, are demanding new efforts to protect public health and food safety. The FDA was asked to respond to a legal petition filed in January 1999 that would change U.S. animal feed regulations to prevent the spread of U.S. mad cow type diseases already occurring in deer, elk, sheep, and humans, and suspected in pigs and cattle. You want more information? Well, you can contact Jennifer Kelly or Amy Leska. Their number 202-463-6670. That's 202-463-6670. And unfortunately, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Special Agents and the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources Conservation Wardens are investigating the poisoning death of an immature female bald eagle south of Montfort, Wisconsin. The eagle was found dead in January. Scientists determined the eagle died after feeding on the carcass of a house cat. Forensic analysis of the cat remains showed the cat had been euthanized by injection with a drug composed of phenobarbital and dilantin. That combination of drugs is available only to veterinarians. Investigators theorized the cat was euthanized by a veterinarian and then taken home for disposal by the pet's owner, and the owner did not properly dispose of the carcass, resulting in the eagle's death. We don't think anyone intentionally poisoned the eagle, said U.S. Fish and Wildlife Special Agent Ed Spoon, but because the dead cat was not disposed of properly, the eagle died. And in California, the Mojave National Preserve harbors the best habitat of all three California desert national parks for the threatened desert tortoise. Unfortunately, the park is also encumbered by the most grazing. 1.25 million acres of the 1.6 million acre park have been open to cattle grazing, specifically allowed in the law which established the park in 1994. The good news is that the National Park Foundation has just purchased the Granite Mountain Ranch and grazing allotments, totaling over 412,000 acres. Of those, 43,000 acres are in critical desert tortoise habitat and over 235,000 acres are in designated wilderness. This removes cattle from the Kelso Dunes area, where Earth First had its organizers' convention this year, the third highest dune system in the United States. While the bulk of the grazing remains, and much of it in critical habitat for the desert tortoise, that's a great start. Unfortunately, in Idaho, Idaho Governor Dirk Kempthorne has announced he will go to court to stop the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service from reintroducing grizzly bears, a federally threatened species, into the wilderness of central Idaho. According to Associated Press, Kempthorne is leading the political opposition to a federal program to release grizzlies into the Selway, Bitterroot, and the Frank Church River of No Return Wilderness Area, some of the wildest stretches of landscape in the lower 48 states. Uncle Sam cannot improve on Mother Nature, Kempthorne explains. Uncle Sam ought to stay out of this. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has just completed its public comment period on the environmental impact statement for the project and expects a decision before the end of the year. The Center for Biological Diversity and the Turtle Island Restoration Network have filed a notice of intent to sue the California Fish and Game Department to protect the California sea otter, a federally endangered species. The suit alleges that the department violated the Federal Endangered Species Act by allowing the killing of California sea otters in the state-managed halibut fishery in the Monterey Bay area. According to the Center for Biological Diversity's press release, the state agency has failed to regulate the fishery despite clear evidence that sea otters are drowning in gill net. And that's just about all the time I have for news. To get news or announcements from your bioregion to Earth First Radio, send us email at cruzef@cruzio.com. That's cruzef@cruzio.com. Or you can send letters to Earth First Radio. We're at P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. Once again, that's Earth First Radio, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. And please be sure to send those announcements at least 3 weeks in advance so I can get them on the air in a timely manner. If you want more in-depth news and information about the Earth First Movement, please subscribe to the Earth First Journal. Their address is P.O. Box 1415, Eugene, Oregon, 97440. That's the Earth First Journal, P.O. Box 1415, Eugene, Oregon, 97440. You can listen to Earth First Radio live on your computer. Go to www.microradio.net/FRSC. That's www.microradio.net/FRSC. Thursday nights from 8 to 10 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. Or you can go to the World Wide Web at www.radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. You'll need a sound card in your computer, but the software you need to play the MP3 files is free on the website, and you can do it anytime. Earth First Radio is carried on a growing number of free speech and non-commercial radio stations. Please ask your local station to rebroadcast Earth First Radio. And Earth First Radio is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. Our theme music was written and performed by Daryl Cherney from the CD Keep It Wild. My name's Uncle Dennis, and I want to thank you for listening to Earth First Radio. And now we're going to listen to some Casey Neal. This is off his Riff Raff CD, and it's called Riff Raff.